This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Today's world spins in the digital domain, and Wired magazine is at the forefront of covering it. Wired reveals the most surprising and resonant stories about the people, companies, technologies, and ideas that are transforming our lives. Wired is on the front lines of the 21st century and keeping you up to date. Coming up next, only on your audio reading service.
Welcome, this is Wired, and I'm your reader, Sam Cantrell, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today we'll be reading from the September-October issue of Wired, copyright 2025, Condé Nast. And now we'll begin with Bloodlines. Master the art of cloning, lock down copies of the world's greatest horses, then dominate the sport of kings. That was the plan, but some technologies are just a breeding ground for betrayal. By Matt Reynolds. The horses are slick with sweat, veins bulging, feet dancing through the maelstrom of legs and mallets and flying clods of earth, 6,000 pounds of flesh tumbling after a tiny white ball. The riders are all furious angels, jabbing their mallets blindly beneath their saddles. But Adolfo Cambasso appears calm. He lifts a gloved hand and swings the head of his mallet in a perfect arc through the tangle of horse and human to thwack the ball and send it clear towards the goal. It's the final game of the 2016 Argentine Open, the most important polo match of the year in the most polo-obsessed country on earth. And there are some 30,000 spectators in the stands, all watching Cambasso's every move. Depending on who you ask, Cambasso may be described as a horse whisperer, a sex symbol, or a marvel of longevity. And it's all true. At 41, he's easily the oldest player on the field. His handsome face and cleft chin, sun-beaten with stubble, his dark hair matted with sweat. But the more universally accepted fact is that Cambasso is the greatest polo player alive, top-ranked for some two decades, if not the greatest who has ever lived. As if that weren't enough, he's also a horse-breeding tycoon who is, on this very field, in this very game, transforming polo from the sport of kings into a frontier laboratory of applied biotechnology. It has been a mean, close match, a battle between Cambasso and Facundo Pires, the only player alive who might challenge his standing atop the sport's rankings. As the game hits its final stages, Cambasso has a critical decision to make. Polo fields are 300 yards long. Even the finest polo ponies tire out after a few minutes of charging at 30 miles per hour. So elite players bring 10 or more horses to each match, switching steeds as many as a dozen times. Cambasso must choose which horse to ride in the game's final stretch. Among his ponies are six lean bay mares with splashes of white staining their foreheads. Cambasso has ridden thousands of horses in his decades-long career, but these mares are special. They are perfect genetic copies, clones made by the company Crestview Genetics, of one of the most celebrated ponies ever to set hoof on a polo field, a prize-winning, recently retired mare called Curatera. As a pair, Cambasso and Curatera were almost unbeatable. Best horse to ever play polo, says equine veterinarian Scott Swerdlin, who helped take care of Cambasso's ponies earlier in his career. She had everything: acceleration, speed, agility, a calm, razor-sharp mind. The horse was, as Argentinians like to say, una máquina. For those last moments of the final, Combasso selects Kutera B06, the sixth clone he helped create. 2 minutes later, this sixth Kutera is tearing up the field as Combasso and his teammates race toward the north end. The ball sprays forward and finds Cambiasso's teammate, who guides it through the posts as the crowd cheers and wave Argentine flags. In moments, it's all over. Combasso and Kutera B06 have won. Player and horse are quickly enveloped in a crush of well-wishers. Among those cheering is Cambasso's son, Adolfo Jr., who goes by the nickname Porto. At 11, he's already a polo-playing prodigy. Also in the throng is Cambasso's business partner, Crestview's founder, Alan Meeker. A lean man with thinning gray hair and dark, serious eyes, Meeker wraps the champion in a hug. Well, beyond the rarefied world of polo, the match is hailed as historic. This is the first time anyone has played a polo final on six identical horses, let alone won with them. The victory not only reinforces Cambasso's reputation as polo's most dominant player, but cements the cloning's place in the sport. Polo aficionados have long treated cloning with skepticism, fearing that cloned offspring would be little more than sickly knockoffs of once great horses. But now a team of clones has resolutely thrashed one of the best horse breeding outfits in existence. Speaking to Science Magazine after the match, Meeker, a Texan who made his fortune in oil, gas, and real estate before convincing Combasso to join his cloning venture, calls the victory a proof of concept. Which concept exactly? For Cambasso, it seems to be this. In a sport where horses are more important than their riders, anyone who can indefinitely clone the best steed in the world has the ultimate edge. If Cambasso can strategically manage his herd of cloned Kutieras, and if young Porto keeps showing promise as a player, this could be the start of a multi-species polo dynasty. His formula is to capitalize on years of horse breeding superiority through cloning, lock down the bloodlines, and dominate the sport. The only flaw is that Cambasso isn't the only one with control of these bloodlines. And one day, nearly 4 years after that 2016 match, a secret deal made on someone else's superyacht will throw the entire formula into disarray. This story, drawing on hundreds of court documents, trial testimonies, and depositions, is the chronicle of that betrayal. It was Imelda Marcos, of all people, who appears to have first planted the idea of cloning in Alan Meeker's mind. This was around the time of the early 2000s fracking boom, when Meeker, a third-generation oil and gas man, was in the business of buying and developing natural gas sites along the Bartlett Shale, a huge gas reserve that covers more than a dozen counties in North Texas. One natural gas field that Meeker hoped to purchase seemed to be connected to Marcos and her deceased husband, the notoriously corrupt former president of the Philippines. To probe the sale, Meeker held a series of phone calls with the very chatty Marcos. During one conversation, Meeker told the former dictator's wife that he'd recently been diagnosed with type 1 diabetes, a condition in which the body's immune system attacks insulin-producing cells in the pancreas. In Meeker's telling, Marcos then mentioned that when her lawyer had come down with pancreatic cancer, her doctors had tried to clone him a new pancreas. Perhaps Meeker should try the same approach. Meeker never did clone his pancreas, but the conversation gave him an idea. Meeker had played amateur polo in his 30s, and he knew how important and how expensive and inefficient traditional horse breeding was to the sport. In late 2008, he started talking to a couple of scientists asking whether it was possible to clone horses. Yes, they told him, though there were no guarantees that the clones would perform as well as the originals on the polo field. Intrigued, Meeker began to search for the perfect horse and polo player to start his cloning experiment. In the summer of 2009, Cambiasso and the oilmen met for the first time on a farm, west of London. Cambiasso listened as Meeker shared his plans for horse cloning. As it happened, Cambiasso was especially primed for the pitch. Years ago, when one of his favorite horses, a stallion named Akin Kura, had to be put down suddenly, Cambiasso had asked his veterinarians to save a genetic sample from the horse's skin in cryogenic storage. He'd been waiting for an opportunity to clone the stallion. In England, the two men hashed out a verbal agreement. Cambiasso would give Meeker's company tissue from five of his best horses, Colibri, Small Person, Dolfina Lapa, Anakin Akin Kura, and Curatera. The initial plan was for Meeker's company to license the technology to clone the horses, and for the men to sell the clones for a minimum of $250,000 each. To sweeten the deal, Meeker's company paid Cambiasso $1 million, which the polo player placed in a Swiss bank account named after Akin Kura. With that, Meeker contracted the world's leading pet cloning clinic, Viagen, to transfer the DNA from Kutera into egg cells and then implant the embryos into donor mares. Those surrogates duly gave birth to 10 clones of the legendary horse and at least 17 copies of other horses owned by Cambiasso. The polo player couldn't believe it. His most prized bloodlines had been made young again. Meeker and Cambiasso later suspected that polo's elites would clamor to get their hands on the DNA of their sport's most legendary horse, but the two businessmen, partners, had no real idea whether their clones would command the $250,000 price that they'd targeted. After all, even the best ponies rarely reached above $200,000, and cloning was virtually unknown in polo at the time. So in November 2010, Cambiasso held his first ever solo auction in San Isidro, an affluent city just north of Buenos Aires, to test the market's appetite. The auction was a major social event in the Argentine polo scene. Players and patrons mingled, drinks in hand, as they weighed up which ponies they might like to add to their stables. It blew past Cambiasso's expectations almost immediately. At the top of the auction, even before any clones went up for bidding, a 50% share in the son of the original Kutera went for $380,000. Soon up for bidding was a six-month-old clone of Kutatera. A palpable buzz of anticipation went through the crowd as the players and patrons sat facing a dramatically lit ring when the foal would be displayed. With only a few minutes to go before bidding started, a longtime friend of Cambiasso's, Argentine's airport tycoon, Ernesto Gutierrez, says he sidled up to the polo player and told him he was about to make a terrible mistake. "You can't sell Kutatera," he pleaded. "You can't sell it because you will be losing your most important bloodline that you have in your breed." Cambiasso could see Gutierrez's point. If the son of Kutatera was fully worth $760,000 at auction, it seemed foolish to sell the bloodline altogether. The horse's DNA was like a trade secret. Sell it away and anyone could breed and market their own Kutatera offspring. As the seconds ticked down, Cambiasso suggested an alternative. Gutierrez could split the cost with a mutual friend, and they could buy the clone themselves. The decision allowed them to control what turned out to be a dizzying, valuable asset. After intense bidding, the clone reportedly went for $800,000, said to be a record for a polo pony. The San Isidro auction changed how Cambasso, Meeker, and Gutierrez, who following another agreement, would soon become their business partner, though about their cloning scheme. The new arrangement, as Cambasso essentially understood it, had one golden rule. Sell all the babies of clones that you like, but the clones themselves must never be sold. You sell everything if you sell a clone, Cambasso would tell 60 Minutes in a 2018 segment. The media was growing increasingly fascinated with Polo's turn toward science fiction. In a 2018 episode of National Geographic Explorer, Meeker sat inside a huge and immaculately designed horse barn, talking about cloning and the inherent riskiness and camaraderie of Polo. A lot of what makes life worth living is dangerous, he said. We are all very good friends from around the world. And then also, he added with a dry smile, we like to win. To play Polo at the highest levels, you have to love horses or be filthy rich, ideally both. A team might field around 40 ponies for each game and draw on a roster of hundreds of potentially playable horses for each tournament. In the gaps between tournaments, top players scour the globe for new equine talent, trying to snaffle foals from elite bloodlines or looking to ex-race horses to uncover a polo star in the rough. Traditional horse breeding is a lottery. Throw together even your best mare and stallion, and there's no way of knowing how their genetics will combine. Their filly could be a dud, and you'd still have to wait several years to know for sure. You take care of the horse, stable it, feed it for 2 years before you even try to ride it. Then you teach it to change leads, listen to your legs, turn on a dime, and go from 30 miles an hour to zero without injuring itself. All along, you pay for vets, grooms, farriers, breakers, feed, transport, and tack. You're taking tens of thousands of dollars each year. Finally, around age 5, the pony is ready for its first polo match. So you take the horse to the field, and it spooks as soon as it takes its first bump from another pony. Now you have an inevitable choice. Do you sink another 10 grand into training, or do you sell the mare at a steep discount? There are the players. Then there are the players. In Argentina, polo is arguably second only to soccer as the sport of national obsession. The top polo players are household names, and those who venture into the international polo circuit are known as hired assassins. Nearly every top-ranked polo player is from Argentina, and so are the sport's best horses. All of this is why polo depends on a system of patronage. Teams are bankrolled by wealthy sponsors who hire the best Argentine assassins while keeping them supplied with Argentine ponies, bridles, bandages, reins, saddles, trailers, trucks, helmets, mallets, knee guards, and the thousands of other expenses a polo team might incur. In return, the patron, a polo amateur, gets to play on the team with them. Finally, a handicap system keeps this delicate dance of money and skill in motion. Polo players are assigned ratings that correspond to their skill. The highest is 10. Cambasso is one of more than a dozen players in the world, and the lowest is a complete novice at -2. Most patrons hover around a handicap of 0. The summed handicaps of all 4 players on a team cannot exceed a certain number, essentially guaranteeing a mix of amateurs, up-and-comers, and seasoned professional players. In the mid-2010s, just as Cambasso was trying out his first clones on the polo field, a new patron emerged on the U.S. polo scene. A former president of the Bank of Moscow, Andrei Borodin, fled his native Russia in 2011, finding political asylum in the UK, where he bought Park Place, the palatial 18th-century estate that once belonged to the father of King George III. The reported £140 million, $187 million, that Borodin paid for Park Place made it the most expensive home ever sold in the UK at the time. Park Place also lent its name to Brodin's new polo team, which the Russian exile started to fill with some of the world's best players and ponies. Aristocratically pale and with a hint of a paunch filling out his royal blue and yellow jersey, Brodin himself played with a handicap of zero. Thanks largely to his skills off the polo field, the Russian billionaire patron and his team began to shake up the English polo scene, winning the 2017 Royal Windsor Cup as Queen Elizabeth II watched from the stands, before turning to high goal matches in the U.S. From almost nothing, Brodin was building Park Place into a formidable new force in elite polo, largely with the sheer power of his fortune. Brodin had the money to buy the best horses on the planet, but he still lacked the edge that Combasso had, the one that wasn't for sale. For nearly 10 years, Meeker, Gutierrez, and Combasso lived by their golden rule: sell the offspring, keep the clones. As the horses matured, Combasso's herd of Gutierrez and other cloned greats started to dominate high goal polo. As a source of genetic material, Cudatera was more than proven her worth, overperforming even in the context of other clones. The problem with cloning, and we don't know why this is, but some horses have the innate ability to pass along genetic qualities that make them amazing polo ponies. And some you clone, and they're not the same horse, says the veterinarian Scott Swerdlund. We don't know why that is, but for sure Cutatera has been very successful. Combasso's son, Porto, was also becoming a polo star. At 15, he already had a handicap of 8 and seemed destined to follow in his father all the way to 10. One day, the father hoped, Porto would ride Cutatera just like he did. With their new cloning agreement, he thought his horse bloodlines could never be separated from his family. As Combasso racked up his victories, the oil man, polo star, and Argentine tycoon grew closer. Both Meeker and Gutierrez could claim some responsibility for Combasso's string of successes. It was Meeker's idea to start cloning the horses, after all, and Gutierrez who helped provide the business model. When the Cutera B09 performed well at a high profile polo match, Meeker was ecstatic. It was the best ever. I raised her, he told Combasso over WhatsApp. We did it. You, Ernesto, and me. We are the dream team. As the U.S. polo season rolled around in the spring, Meeker and his son would often visit the Combassos in Florida. His son was similar in age to Porto, and the two boys would play polo together, sometimes roping in their fathers for practice games. If he ever runs away from home, I will have to call you and Combasso's wife, Maria, because that's where he would go. Meeker messaged Combasso in 2018. The polo player promised that he'd help Meeker's son with anything he needed in polo. Meeker told Combasso he dreamed of a day when his son, Aiden, would sponsor Porto Combasso's team and the two boys would ride on cloned horses together. More than anything, the men trusted one another. Loyalties shift quickly in polo, and with the clones gathering so much attention, there was always the possibility that a jealous rival would try to come between them. Still, the oil man and the polo star had been through enough to know that they could rely on one another. I appreciate your friendship more than anything, Meeker said in an August 2018 message. His friend agreed. Me too. Thank you, Alan. I feel safe with you. He shouldn't have. In October 2020, Alan Meeker stepped aboard the deck of Amaryllis, a 257-foot super yacht docked in the Bahamas. With 6 staterooms, a gym, spa, sun deck, and room for 12 guests and 23 crew, the vessel cut an imposing silhouette against the Caribbean sky. Meeker was there to negotiate a deal. On the yacht was Andre Borodin. His team, Park Place Polo, was now ranked alongside the best teams in the world and had recently defeated Combasso's team to qualify for the semifinals of the Queen's Cup, only to narrowly lose in the final. but Borodin seemed to want more, and Meeker was in the process of agreeing to sell the Russian exile 3 Kutatera clones for $2.4 million. This was exactly the kind of deal that the three business partners, Meeker, Gutierrez, and Cambasso, had decided against after the San Isidro auction back in 2010. And Borodin's associates suspected as much. They were very wary about the deal. Everyone knew Kutatera was one of the most famous horses in polo. Surely Cambasso would be livid if he found out his most prized bloodline was being sold without his knowledge. The patron's associates were curious to figure out whether Meeker really did have the right to sell the cloned horses. Meeker had assured Borodin's colleague that he had license to clone Kutatera, but when it came to pinning this down in a contract, the oil man would remove these guarantees from drafts of the agreements. To Borodin's employees, that seems strange. The two sides traded confidentiality agreements, contracts, assurances, and legal fallbacks in case the deal went sour. Borodin's side insisted that $250,000 of the sale price be held in escrow in case Cambasso sued in an attempt to recover the cloned horses. Meeker's patience seemed to grow thin. He was eager to get the deal signed, but was being bogged down by lawyers. The Texan figured he had nothing to fear. He doubted his polo-playing friend would have the guts to sue, even if he did find out about the deal. "I fear we are drowning in a fever swamp of overanalyzation, paralyzation regarding what-ifs and legal theories that could be cooked up by an Argentine that doesn't have the wherewithal nor the fortitude to create massive litigation," he wrote in an email to one of Borodin's lawyers. Borodin's associates held their noses, and the Texan got his deal. In addition to the three cloned horses, Meeker's company would assist Park Place in setting up its own horse cloning laboratory. Not only was he selling access to Kutatero's bloodlines, Meeker was giving Park Place the ability to replicate them indefinitely. If Meeker's deal went to plan, then Park Place would no longer be just the team that bought the best ponies out there. It would be a cloning operation to rival Cambasso's, with access to the same precious bloodlines the Argentinian had based his legacy upon. On November 17, 2020, a trailer set off from Crestview's ranch in Aiken, South Carolina. It was bound for the village of Wellington, Florida, to a property hidden by a gate flanked by the Park Place crest. Inside the trailer were three bay fillies with stripes of white down their long faces. On the shipping documents, the three ponies were identified by numbers, B10, B11, and B12. But the animals shared a name, just as they shared everything else. They were all Kutateras. Around the time when the three Kutateras made their way down to Wellington in November of 2020, Adolfo Cambasso was preparing to play in the Argentine Open once more. It had been a strange season. His team had been mired by injuries, and the stadiums, thanks to the COVID-19 pandemic, were eerily empty. But at least the polo legend had been able to play alongside his son on his home turf. "It's a joy to play with him," Cambasso told Pololine at the time. His friendship with Meeker had cooled during the pandemic year. Unbeknownst to Cambasso, the oilman had been shopping his clones around to potential buyers in the United Arab Emirates and China, as well as to Borodin. In Instagram messages and a phone call, Meeker even teased selling clones to Bartolomo Castagoglia, a top-ranked polo rival who was married to Cambasso's sister. Meeker hinted that there might be more Kutateras for sale, Castolia later said in an affidavit. It wasn't long before the rumors were flying in the notoriously gossipy polo scene. Meeker thought about coming clean before he was found out, but if Cambasso was going to get wind of the deal anyway, Meeker mused, he could be strategic with the timing of his revelation. Why not tell the polo player about the sale of the three clones the night before his biggest game of the year, the Argentinian Open Final? In the end, it was about a month before the final when Combasso found out his bloodlines had leaked. The news left the Argentine dismayed. He would later testify that bloodlines wasn't meant just for him. It was supposed to secure the future of Porto and his daughter Mia, who was a rising polo star in her own right. Suddenly, the whole family seemed in jeopardy. As soon as a single clone was out of his hands, Cutatera's bloodline was lost to him forever. If Cutatera's DNA had escaped his grasp, then he could see that there was nothing to stop Borodin, or anyone else for that matter, from cloning the prize pony over and over again. The top polo tournaments could be flooded with Cutateras. In December, he sued Meeker to try to get his horses back. Shortly thereafter, on orders from the court, Borodin's three clones were shipped back to Meeker's farm in South Carolina until the litigation was resolved. Early in the morning on April 24, 2024, Combasso sat in a wood-paneled courtroom at the Alto Lee Adams Sr. Courthouse in Fort Pierce, Florida, the same building where Donald Trump would face more than 40 felony counts related to allegedly withholding classified documents. Alan Meeker sat a few feet away, flanked by several lawyers. More than 3 years had passed since the oil man turned horse cloner and his Crestview businesses had been summoned to a civil trial, one of the first courtroom battles over horse cloning in U.S. history. It had been 3 years of claims, counterclaims, and tedious legal wrangling. Three years in which the most Combasso heard about his clone Cutateras was that they were being trained in South Carolina. Even the looming legal battle did not stop Meeker from the task he had set out to accomplish. During litigation, he continued to clone Cutateras under the alias CF Symphony and CF Pantera. Polo is a small world, and the world of horse cloning smaller still. There was barely a figure involved in either field that didn't touch the case in some shape or form. Combasso and Meeker both took the stand, as did their former business partner Ernesto Gutierrez and the veterinarian Scott Swerdlin. Borodin didn't appear. Park Place Polo Team Corporation had been named as a defendant at one point, then removed from the suit. But one of his associates was sent to observe the case and was later called as a witness for the plaintiffs. In the trial, Meeker and his companies faced nearly a dozen different claims. Combasso's lawyers alleged that the oilman had breached multiple agreements and misappropriated a trade secret when he sold the Cutatera clones to Park Place. The lawyers demanded that Meeker return any cloned horses and tissue that were still in his possession and stop using Cutatera's DNA in any way. Meeker, who was accompanied at the witness stand by his diabetes alert dog, Pico, in turn accused Combasso of breaking multiple agreements the two men had and their companies had made. Plus, Meeker claimed, an early agreement with Combasso gave him license to sell the clones. As the trial got underway, Porto watched his father from the gallery. As one of Combasso's lawyers, Francis McDonald, stood to make his opening statement, he gestured toward the client's son. At 17, Porto had become the youngest polo player to reach the maximum handicap of 10. It looked like the young star was on track to eclipse his father's legendary achievements on the field. Just 3 days earlier, Porto had beaten his father in the final of the U.S. Open. This case was about that legacy, but in the eyes of the plaintiffs, it also boiled down to something much easier to understand: betrayal. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, there is no country or society or business or LLC in the world where what Mr. Meeker did behind Adolfo's back would be considered right. There just isn't, McDonald told the jury during his closing argument 8 long and torturous days later. McDonald worked up to his final flourish. What drove Meeker to turn his back on his former friend, a man he had once implied could be another father to his son? Shortly before he started negotiating the deal to sell the clones, Meeker had lost another legal battle over an unpaid contract involving a genomics testing company he had co-founded and was served with a judgment to pay $1.4 million. Alan Meeker needed money. Alan Meeker needed to do something to get rid of some things, and what did he do? He turned it all against his former business associate and best friend and sold clones behind his back. In April 2025, I flew to Wellington, Florida for the knockout stages of the U.S. Open. Wellington bills itself as the winter equestrian capital of the world. Between January and April each year, some 20,000 horses pass through the village, heading to show jumping and dressage events or to compete in high goal polo. Viewed from the sky, the village glitters with emerald lozenges of polo fields, occasionally interrupted by a tack shop or a row of stables. Even a local middle school there is named Polo Park. I go to meet the veterinarian Scott Swerdlin at the Palm Beach Equine Clinic, which has the feel of a high-end health club. Swerdlin tells me that Combasso's breeding operations produce several thousand horse embryos a year. That's a tremendous investment in the industry and in horse flesh. Plus, he clones a lot of the horses. It's really about organization. Organization and bloodlines. One of Swerdlin's colleagues leads me to a cramped room filled with tanks of liquid nitrogen. It's a little more than a storage cupboard, but here is where they store semen from stud horses used to inseminate mares. A stud contract might go for $5,000, making the room worth hundreds of thousands of dollars. Inside one of the canisters tucked into a corner of the room is a sample of DNA from Kutatera herself. Head out of Palm Beach Equine Clinic, a short drive west, past the dank canals flanking the roads, and down the long palm-fringed highway, and you'll end up at the National Polo Center, the gaudy, glamorous home of the polo in the U.S. It is here, a few days after my visit to the clinic, that the two Combassos, father and son, ride out to face each other in the U.S. Open final once more. By a little past the halfway point, it was clear that this wouldn't be the moment when Porto eclipsed his father once and for all. The 50-year-old Adolfo's team in running away with the match. As the players line up for a throw-in, the younger Combasso races back to jump onto a new mare, her white coat shining in the afternoon sun. The horse tosses her head to the side as Porto pulls her around to his right, toward the south end of the field. He races toward the goalposts with his father close behind, mallet raised in the air. Cut off by his charging father, Porto desperately tries for a narrow shot toward the goal, but the ball bobbles off the pitch toward a hedgerow. A few minutes later, it's all over. Adolfo has won decisively. At the final bell, the son rides up to his father, and the two men clasp hands briefly. They embrace. After that, Adolfo is swallowed by a crowd of people wearing his team colors, grinning, the air muggy with scent of horse sweat and champagne as people clamor to snatch a moment of the polo legend before he recedes from view. In any event, the two Combassos will still have their horses. In Florida, the jury and the judge sided with the polo star, ordering that Meeker return to Combasso all the clones he had in his possession. In a post-trial deposition, Meeker was asked if he knew whether Borodin had extracted any tissue from the Kutatera clones he'd bought. Meeker said he didn't know. In March 2025, the two sides announced to the court that they had reached a preliminary settlement agreement. Around the same time, an LLC managed by Meeker sold Crestview's farms in Aiken for $6.8 million. None of the parties involved in the court case responded to Wired's request for comment. The original Kutatera died on May 4, 2023, right in the middle of the legal battle over her DNA. Combasso was distraught, calling her the best mare he had ever ridden, and it's a sad moment indeed. Very painful for me, poor thing, he told Polo Magazine at the time. Cuchitera's bloodline, of course, lives on in the dozens of clones and folds she produced, and perhaps in one way or another, too. In 2017, it was rumored that the Argentine Association of Polo Horse Breeders had plans to make a bronze statue of the peerless mare to be placed outside the Campo Argentino de Polo, the same venue where Adolfo Cambasso had changed polo forever by riding his six clones to victory. The statue would be the only life-size replica of the most famous polo pony of all time. That was the idea, at least. In April 2017, a Texas oilman got wind of the plan to cast Cuchitera in bronze. At a moment when everyone was still on good terms, Alan Meeker fired off a message to one of Adolfo Cambosso's closest associates. He had a spot on his farm that would be perfect for a statue of the horse. Could he make another copy? Matt Reynolds is a science journalist based in London. And now from the online version of Wired, cult brand. Palantir wants to be a lifestyle brand. Defense tech giant Palantir is selling t-shirts and tote bags as part of a bid to encourage fans to publicly endorse it. By Caroline Haskins, 9/22/25 at 6 a.m. Palantir Technologies, which moved from Silicon Valley to Denver in 2020, sells software that immigration authorities use to identify and arrest people. Militaries use it to organize drone strikes, and corporations use it to manage their supply chains. Now it also sells tote bags. Last year, Palantir relaunched an online merchandise store, and its website was recently redesigned with a swanky interface and a new payment system. A mock terminal in the lower left corner displays code documenting each item you view. A page titled Core Capsule displays an assortment of sold-out items like athletic shorts with text reading PLTR-TECH running down the right butt cheek, which sold for $99. It also shows a puffy ergonomic nylon tote bag that was priced at $119 and a Palantir baseball cap that ran for $55. The site is relaunching on Thursday evening with a new merch drop. Many companies produce branded swag for their employees and clients, including the legacy defense contractors that Palantir is trying to disrupt. Lockheed Martin sells a skunk stuffed animal, a nod to its R&D team that started secret operations under the name Skunk Works during World War II. Boeing sells t-shirts and keychains depicting various military aircraft, like its B-52 bombers and the AH-64 attack helicopters. They're products that may appeal to current or former employees or their friends and family. But what Palantir is doing feels more ambitious. The company seemingly wants to be a lifestyle brand. Elano Yones, the company's head of strategic engagement who runs the merch store and posts about it frequently on X, has been explicit about it in multiple posts. Palantir is the lifestyle brand, Yones posted on X in March. The most pro-West, meritocratic, winning-obsessed, and based brand on the face of the earth. But what does it mean for Palantir, a company that, in the words of the former employee, essentially sells digital filing cabinets to customers like Immigration and Customs Enforcement and the U.S. Department of Defense, Heineken Beer, and General Mills to be a lifestyle brand? The cult of Palantir. Lifestyle brands sell products that people buy to express their identities, whether they're Tesla supervans, Zen bros, or Hydro Flask water bottle girlies. These brands aren't necessarily successful because they have a superior product, but rather because they're skilled at proposing an original point of view and influencing a social context, argues the book Lifestyle Brands, co-written by management professor Stefania Savillo and brand consultant Antonio Mazzara. Using the products they sell as a symbolic act, a way to signal status, or demonstrate a sense of belonging to a group. Generally, lifestyle brands are known for products they sell to the public. people recognize Tesla as a company that sells cars and Zyn, a company that sells nicotine pouches. To state the obvious, Palantir is not a clothing company, and the software it does sell is not consumer-facing. Its price tag is so large that often giant government agencies and corporations are the only ones that can afford it. Palantir is not exactly an obvious candidate for a lifestyle brand. And yet, despite the odds, Palantir has a fan base that includes many potential merch customers. Palantir bros are not hard to encounter online. There are several Palantir-focused subreddits, the largest of which has 109,000 members. Some people on X have been able to amass huge followings by posting exclusively about the company throughout the day. Palantir fans can obsessively focus on the company's stock price. They can behave like American football fans when it goes up, celebrating as if their team scored a touchdown. When it gets a big contract, as if their team got a new star player. In this context, it makes sense that people would want to purchase merch. It's like buying a jersey. Palantir's fan base gradually expanded during the years that contractors for immigration and enforcement and the military were least popular in Silicon Valley. For fans, Palantir was a contrarian dark horse that stood by its principles, even though others detest them. For Palantir, becoming a lifestyle brand seems more about getting the company's fans to publicly identify with its brand and its mission. This is made explicit on a white note card with CEO Alex Karp's signature that was included with recent orders of Palantir merch. "Thank you for your dedication to Palantir and our mission to defend the West," the card reads. "The future belongs to those who believe and build, and we build to dominate." Jonas has expressed a similar sentiment. "Palantir isn't just a software company," he wrote on X in August. "It's a worldview, Western values, pro-warfighter, problem-solving, conviction, dominant software, etc. That's why people rep the gear." These values have not always been popular in Silicon Valley. In fact, historically, they've been outright rejected. In 2018, thousands of Google workers rallied against the company's involvement with Project Maven, a Pentagon project analyzing drone footage with AI. Conceding to the workers, Google chose not to renew its Maven contract but said it wouldn't stop working with the Pentagon. That same year, protests against Palantir were popping up in Palo Alto in response to the company's work with ICE. ICE did not cancel any contracts. However, under the second Trump administration, the tech world is beginning to openly embrace alignment with the military, both transactionally and symbolically. In June, the Army commissioned an elite group of tech executives to be lieutenant colonels. Palantir Chief Technology Officer Shyam Sankar was joined by Meta Chief Technology Officer Andrew Bosworth, OpenAI Chief Product Officer Kevin Weil, and current Thinking Machines Lab Advisor and former OpenAI Chief Research Officer Bob McGrew, who also worked at Palantir. Palantir's current merch store appears to capitalize on this vibe change and communicate that the company is doubling down on its reputation, branding, and mission. In an April letter to shareholders, Karp wrote that the mission was for years dismissed as politically fraught and ill-advised. "We, the heretics, this motley band of characters, were cast out and nearly discarded by Silicon Valley," Karp wrote. And yet there are signs that some within the valley have now turned a corner and begun following our lead. One of Palantir's first merch releases was a black shirt with a giant red graphic. The oblong shape resembles an oval projection of the Earth. There are three lines inside the oval that evoke latitude-longitude lines, or a wireframe globe. In the direct center, there's the Palantir logo. Symbolically, it looks like Palantir is controlling the world. Ironically, one of the most common misconceptions about Palantir is that it's one giant database with information from every single one of its clients. The company has published several blogs trying to dispel this myth on a factual basis. The shirt, by contrast, appears to take a different approach. It symbolically mocks, embraces, and dismisses this misconception. It seemingly was created with precisely Karp's heretics in mind. Made in America. At the core of Palantir's merch identity is its insistence that all the products are made in the USA. Like many other companies, Palantir wants to evoke a sense of pride in supporting American workers. But it's very expensive to produce clothes made in the United States, especially ones with custom tags and high-quality materials, as the company claims. Palantir's head of strategic development has said that the goal of the merch store, financially, is to simply break even. When the website relaunched, Jones blamed tariffs for the higher cost of the merchandise. This will not be a new revenue stream, he posted in May 2024. Simply put, Palantir doesn't have to do this. In fact, Palantir has actually tried and failed to run a merch store before. Archives of the old store show a simple white website with nondescript t-shirts and hats. At the time, some customers complained that they were cheaply made and unattractive. Palantir shut it down in 2023. Palantir isn't alone. The defense tech company Anduril, which is known for embracing working with U.S. immigration authorities early in its history, launched a gear store shortly after Palantir relaunched its own. It sells shiny black flight jackets, Hawaiian shirts, not unlike the one CEO Palmer Luckey is known to sport, and t-shirts that say workandrol.com in black sans serif text overlaid with "don't" scrawled in black graffiti, seemingly an attempt to look rebellious and cheeky like Palantir. The company is eager to note when its products are made in the U.S. of A. Wired was unable to independently confirm details about the production of Palantir and Anduril merch, including whether it was made in America or which manufacturers they used. Neither company responded to a request for comment on the topic. Garments made in the U.S. are typically made by immigrants, which make up more than 40% of the workforce. Many of them are undocumented and can be compensated by tasks completed rather than being paid by the hour, which overwhelmingly adds up to far below the minimum wage. Palantir has been doing a lot of work for ICE under Trump 2.0. Since April, it has been building Immigration OS, a new system for the agency to, ideally, have a near real-time visibility on people self-deporting. Public documents are not clear about how Immigration OS would do this or what data it would use. ICE is paying Palantir $30 million to do this. Palantir is scheduled to provide ICE with a prototype of Immigration OS on September 25th. On September 18th, it released its new merch. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Sam Cantrell with Wired, and I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.